The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here's a story for you. It's about an evangelical Christian from a TV show that celebrates traditional family values. He worked for the Conservative Family Research Council that helps fund right-leaning campaigns. Pictures of him with several GOP hopefuls flood his social media pages. Then he's exposed, accused of sexually molesting five young girls, four of whom were his sisters, and his parents try to cover the whole thing up. That man is Josh Duggar, one of the many Duggars from the 19 Kids and Counting reality TV show on TLC. Sponsors drop the show and high-profile Republicans back away. That's big news, right? And who broke the story? Not CNN or the New York Times or even TMZ, but the tabloid magazine In Touch. Anne Helen Peterson wrote for BuzzFeed about how In Touch's Duggar's coverage has changed tabloid journalism. Anne Helen Peterson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, first, before we get to the Duggar scoop, a little bit on the story itself.
The Duggars have been part of the national consciousness for almost a decade now. There were a couple of specials that were detailing their life and just like the abundance of children that they had. And I think people were very interested in them, not just for their values, this particular sort of Christianity that they practice, but also just how do you, you know, have a house, feed, transport this many children. And then the gossip magazines have also been very interested in them as the next generation of Duggars have started giving birth to their own children. You know, it's everyone loves a baby story. And so they were on the cover of several magazines in the months leading up to what happened recently.
So what did happen recently?
Well, basically, there was a revelation, and this has been long been circulating in various forums on the internet, that one of the sons had engaged in inappropriate touching with several members of the family and a member whose name has not been revealed, not of the family, when these girls were, you know, under the age of 13. Nothing happened with this initial investigation. And now it is past the statute of limitations in terms of prosecuting him. So there's nothing that can actually happen to this man, right? But the family has publicly admitted that this is something that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So really, he's being held guilty in the court of public opinion, if not by the actual legal system.
And he resigned his very important, you know, executive level position at the Family Research Council. The scoop on this recalls the heyday of print tabloids. So can you give us a little history first on American tabloid journalism, how it got to where it is today?
You know, I think the way that most people understand tabloid journalism, they know the National Enquirer, Star, Sun, those publications that you see in the checkout aisle at the grocery store. But really, those didn't become how we think of them today until the 1960s, 1970s. And in the 30, 40 years since, especially the National Enquirer developed these very strong investigative arms, in part because they were willing to go after stories that other publications were not. They paid for stories, and that's something that is generally thought of as unethical in American schools of journalism. But many of these journalists for the National Enquirer were taken from British publications. And in Britain, it's not seen as unethical to pay for stories.
What are some of the stories that have been broken by tabloids recently that we might recognize?
Yeah, John Edwards' child that in a relationship that he had out of wedlock is probably the most famous and was also the one that the National Enquirer was allowed to submit for Pulitzer Prize consideration.
Can you imagine if the National Enquirer had won a Pulitzer Prize?
I mean, it would be, I actually don't think that it's that far off. Like all sorts of publications are able to win Pulitzer Prize, oftentimes ones that, you know, in their back pages run things that we might scoff at or think are silly. And so I think it's more just like the reputation of the tabloid as something that more often does rumors about people's love lives, things that are feminized and trivialized in popular culture.
Well, how about In Touch? Where does that live in the world of tabloids? How would it be distinguished from, say, People magazine, for example?
In Touch was really designed as this hybrid. You know, they saw that the National Enquirer was Bauer Publications, the people who decided to launch In Touch, saw that the National Enquirer was losing some of its readership, in part to old age, in part because they weren't adapting online. But then they also saw how successful People magazine was. And so they wanted this hybrid between the tabloid style and the more personality journalism, which is the name for what People magazine does. And so they started really kind of in the center of that in the early 2000s and exploited a huge hunger for gossip that developed at the intersection of very prominent celebrity scandals, including like Tom Cruise's courting of Katie Holmes and the relationship between Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, but also the rise of digital photography and how readily photos of celebrities were available. And gradually over the last 10 years, they've become more tabloid and less personality journalism.
Well, In Touch is something, you know, I pick up when I'm in the supermarket checkout. It's a gossip rag. But now that celebrity gossip is rising to the level of news, and you know, we even have a now former reality TV star running for president, is there a bigger, more important place for celebrity gossip, basically, in our news cycle?
I mean, celebrity gossip, especially the way that I've always conceived of it, it's a way of talking about issues that matter. Right. So we talk about a celebrity who has acted out in some way as a way of talking through, OK, what is this sort of performance of femininity or masculinity or queerness or whatever? How do we feel about this? And you just get it's all consolidated in the form of the celebrity. Right. And so I think that in a lot of ways, celebrity gossip gives us a real opportunity to discuss candidates in a way that's meaningful and not necessarily rooted in the more kind of serious politics. Not that policy doesn't matter, but also, you know, the way that we conceive of politicians today isn't as policymakers, it's as figures that live in the imagination of the world, right? And so the fact that the Obamas were on the cover of People magazine, that did more to engender goodwill towards them than, say, you know, even a feature in Time magazine.
We're talking about a politically connected Christian conservative TV star accused of molesting 5 young girls. Well, that would be Josh Duggar from the 19 Kids and Counting reality TV show. The story of his abuse and the attempted cover-up initially by his family was reported not by a traditional investigative journalism source, but the gossip magazine In Touch. Anne Helen Peterson is with us. She did her dissertation on gossip and its sources and now writes features for BuzzFeed. So this business model is based on luring people in with tacky photographs and the, you know, declamatory headlines, not necessarily for the articles to be read, certainly. So what has happened to In Touch and other supermarket checkout tabloids in the age of celebrity Twitter when they can speak for themselves and other online gossip sources?
Oh, I think there's absolutely still hunger for this. I mean, the thing that In Touch does so well, and you know, people in Us Weekly continue to do this as well, is narrativize gossip. Because the thing is that a lot of times people don't actually want to know what's actually going on. They want to think of celebrity lives in the same sort of, you know, melodrama as the films and television shows in which these celebrities star. And so what you want to see is some sort of change. You want to think about, okay, what about these different possibilities, like getting married, getting divorced, having a baby? And those are the different avenues that each of these publications suggest. Now, In Touch has struggled because they have never been adapting to online markets. Like, their website is just pretty atrocious and basic. But TMC, for example, has really taken over the market that used to be filled by the National Enquirer. And TMC does incredible investigative journalism as well.
Well, I know that it's a complicated story of how the Duggar scoop came about. There were FOIA requests, door-to-door investigation, a tip line, you know, some real old-fashioned, dogged journalism. Can you give us some of the highlights of how this story actually got uncovered?
First of all, they went into these online forums where these rumors had been circulating for so long and assessed, okay, what is the probability, what's our capability to confirm any of these? And from there, they started to issue FOIA requests. And one important thing is in Arkansas, you can't request a Freedom of Information Act request unless you are a resident of Arkansas. So they engaged a law firm there to submit these requests, and that, you know, just kind of opened up this waterfall of information. And they say that there's actually more information that they haven't yet released. It remains to be seen whether that's the case. But I mean, a lot of it was, you know, talking to one person on the street who led them to another person, like just, you know, knocking on doors, trying to get leads that way, sort of thing. And that's a sort of commitment to a story that most publications cannot afford.
Well, I was thinking, and it's also, it sounds like a kind of steady pursuit of the truth. I don't necessarily think of InTouch's headlines and articles as being, quote, true.
Right. And I mean, I think that they would say that they mix, you know, these sort of pursuits of the truth, whether it's John Edwards or this case, with things that are more of that, you know, quote unquote, frivolous and melodramatic creation. And I think these magazines have created a reputation in which we are dubious of anything that comes out of them. So, you know, they say they have so many stories. They've broken all these stories before people have actually picked up on them. But again, why would you believe something when it's in touch? So, you know, with this, even when I opened up the initial story when they had this, I was like, I don't know about this. Like, it says it's from InTouch. Like, I was dubious. But I think it's a great example of why we should look actually at the way that a story was pursued and acquired and not necessarily at the publication from whence it comes.
What do you think? Has InTouch's Duggar's coverage changed tabloid journalism, as your headline says?
Well, I think really what it has done is made us reconsider tabloids and hybrid publications like InTouch as a potential source of investigative journalism. Even the publication that I work for, BuzzFeed, is one of many publications that has made it clear that just because something comes from online, just because something comes with a cover that's in pastels, doesn't necessarily mean that it's not of the same caliber as traditional news media.
Ann Helen Peterson, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Ann Helen Peterson, she's a features writer for BuzzFeed, and you'll find a link to read her article, How InTouch's Duggar's Coverage Has Changed Tabloid Journalism.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You'd think that building a monument dedicated to free speech would be a welcome endeavor, given the importance Americans place on the First Amendment. But free speech has always been easier in principle than in practice. Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible brings us this story of an artist fighting to express that very freedom.
In the middle of Sproul Plaza on the campus of UC Berkeley is a sculpture 60,000 feet tall. But don't feel bad if you've never noticed it before.
I've had people, you know, come and look for it specifically and not find it. That makes me think, well, maybe I should have made it a little bigger.
Or maybe that's just the cost of making an invisible sculpture.
I'm kind of setting myself up, aren't I?
That's Mark Bresvan Kempen. His invisible sculpture is known to most as the Free Speech Monument.
It's called Column of Earth and Air.
It's a 6-inch circle of soil and the column of air above it, extending all the way to the limit of U.S.-controlled airspace, hence the 60,000 feet. The column is marked by a 6-foot granite ring embedded flush into the concrete of the plaza. The inscription of the outer edge reads,
"This soil and the airspace extending above it shall not be part of any nation and shall not be subject to any entity's jurisdiction."
It's a sculpture that eschews the traditional materials of wood, clay, or metal, and instead uses
jurisdiction, laws, and politics as kind of material to work with.
The Free Speech Monument has both subtlety and grandeur, and it's also just fun and thought-provoking, a new way to consider jurisdictional space.
Usually, spaces of jurisdiction you enter into. You cross into a country, you cross into a state, you move into somebody's private property. And I thought it would be interesting to kind of invert that and have a space that sort of moves through your body.
And when you stand next to it today, 20 years after it was installed, you'd never suspect the drama that went on to get this granite circle placed in the ground on university property.
I was kind of thrown into a little bit of a hornet's nest that I wasn't prepared for at all.
Here's what happened. The Free Speech Monument was born out of an open design competition to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the start of the free speech movement.
A bunch of professors, ex-professors.
They called themselves the Berkeley Art Project.
Put this competition together separate from the university.
They did it as an autonomous group.
Because they knew if they tried to go through the university to commemorate the free speech movement, it would go nowhere. Because at the time, the university did not want to commemorate the free speech movement in any way, shape, or form.
The free speech movement started in the fall of 1964 when students set up a table in Sproul Plaza to recruit for an off-campus civil rights group. This was against school policy at the time. And everything escalated from there. The following months were marked by sit-ins and strikes and arrests. It was a pivotal moment that defined what we think of as the 60s. So a monument seems appropriate.
So anyway, it's 1989, the call went out, hundreds of designs were considered.
Close to 300 entries from all over the country. They weeded that down to 5.
And there was this open period of public discussion and voting that included the public and art critics and all kinds of people outside of the Berkeley Art Project that eventually selected Mark Bress Van Kempen's Column of Earth and Air as the free speech monument.
Democracy doesn't always work with art, though, so I'm glad that it worked out this time. The people who had put the project together wanted to give the winning entry to the university as a gift. And then, of course, the university did not want to accept it as a gift and did everything that they could not to.
And the reason for the reluctance is that a lot of the Berkeley Art Project group, the ones commissioning the monument, and the higher-ups at the university were the same people who were in the fight 25 years before.
And they were still very upset about it. They still had very hurt feelings.
So UC Berkeley did not want to memorialize the free speech movement in general.
And they hated this piece in particular.
Yeah, so
they did everything in their power to not accept this gift.
Which is kind of hard to do and still seem like a good guy. And after this big public selection process, they didn't have too much of a choice. So the university decided to accept the sculpture under one condition.
They said, okay, we'll accept this commemoration to free speech as long as the press release that goes out does not contain any reference to the free speech movement.
That's right. The free speech monument was censored. And the unintended side effect is that it made a piece of conceptual art conceptually better.
Ironically, it wasn't just the university administration that had a problem with the Column of Earth and Air. A couple of the early free speech movement leaders expressed their misgivings about the monument as well.
You've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate...
I remember having a conversation with Mario Savio.
...that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
He didn't like the piece at all. And not to put words in his mouth, but I did kind of get the impression that he wanted something that was a little bit more specific to the free speech movement in the 60s. And I specifically didn't want to do that. It seemed more relevant to me to use a real person speaking freely about something that they felt strongly about at that moment as a monument to free speech rather than a statue or something like that.
The piece itself remains unfinished. The goal was to completely liberate this 6-inch circle of soil at the center from any jurisdiction. And to do that,
it would have to go through all the jurisdictions, you know, the private property owners, the Board of Regents, the City of Berkeley, County of Alameda, the state. There would have to be an act of Congress. You'd also have to get international treaties because you don't want France coming in and taking that little piece of land. So, you know, it'll probably never be completely finished.
After several attempts, he made it only to the city jurisdictional level before getting thwarted. And now, 20 years after it was installed, I'm standing in a noisy Sproul Plaza with Mark Bress Van Kempen, and we run our hands through the Column of Air. And even though the jurisdiction-free zone was never formalized, I asked him if he feels something when he passes through the invisible column.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I feel like I can feel the space, you know. I grew up in Utah. And I would go to southern Utah a lot in the Four Corners area.
That's the only place in the United States where four states come together at one point.
I remember very specifically jumping from state to state, from Arizona to Colorado to Utah.
To New Mexico.
It's also fun to lie down, spread eagle, in all four states at once.
And really having a visceral feeling about that invisible line. Obviously, it's just psychological, but those spaces are very real. I mean, you commit certain acts in one space, and you can do it. You commit certain acts in another space, and you might be killed. So even though they're imaginary, to a certain extent, they're very real.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible. Coming up after a break, another unusual form of reporting covered by free speech, weird news. We'll talk about how oddball journalism has gone mainstream in the digital age. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Man who allegedly licked toad arrested for trespassing. Man who steals car can't drive, calls taxi. Guy wakes up to find bear nibbling at his ankle. No, these are not headlines from The Onion, but genuine bits of bizarre news from the weird section of The Huffington Post. Once sequestered to collections like Ripley's Believe It or Not or FARC.com, oddball journalism has gone mainstream in the digital age. Even NPR has a category for so-called strange news. And you just know this stuff is going to end up on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Daniel Engber is contributor for Pacific Standard, where he recently wrote about how the internet has forever changed the way we consume and maybe even appreciate bizarre news. Daniel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So for a long time, there was this syndicated column, News of the Weird, preeminent in the collections of oddball journalism. Is it still around?
It is. It's, I would say, somewhat limping along. It was a syndicated newspaper column in all weeklies all across the U.S. It's still printed in some, not as many as it once was at its peak. I think it was in about 300 newspapers. And you can read it online.
What kind of stories are published in News of the Weird and by whom?
News of the Weird is, it's really the work of one guy named Chuck Shepard, who's a government lawyer and a professor in Washington, D.C., now lives in Florida, of course, as all weird news originates from Florida. And it started when he just, as I guess many people have, he just started clipping out articles, strange articles from newspapers for his own amusement. Then he started pasting them into kind of his own photocopied zine that he sent out to friends. And this grew and grew and grew until it became his whole career. He quit all of his other jobs and he's still doing it full time.
Well, one of the things that I found so interesting about your article is that you kind of go back through the history of weird oddball news. A lot of it was originally collected by people who were thought to be oddballs.
Yes. If you go back far enough, you're really in this world where there wasn't much distinction between weird facts about the world and kind of the weirdos who would dig up those facts. So, I mean, even some important early scientists, Robert Hooke would look very closely at his own urine to see, what scientific facts he could learn from it. This was important science, but then he was deemed a real strange guy in his time. And so as you go forward, I think that tradition kind of continues, that you have a lot of these sort of marginal type people who are collecting stories of other marginal people or just collecting weird facts. One of the very first weird news collectors in the sense that we know it today, like Chuck Shepard, would be William Thomas Beckford, who started clipping out strange stories from the newspaper in the 1780s. Now, Beckford himself was a homosexual, and he sort of ended up getting almost sequestered in his Gothic abbey. He's a very wealthy man, and he just stayed inside after being kind of shunned by society. Mm-hmm. For someone like William Thomas Beckford, one gets the sense that there was a feeling of solidarity here, that that he was certainly a bit of an oddball in his time, and And he was sort of collecting stories of others like him. You know, there was no internet where you could instantly join a message board with anyone who shares whatever interests or proclivities you might have. So this was a way, I think, for weird people to connect. But of course, you know, the newspapers themselves were publishing stories of weird people, and that was probably for just the entertainment of everyone else.
Well, for a long time, I didn't think it was true. I thought it was just satire. I mean, how much of it is satirical? Is oddball news, does it have to be true?
I think it is traditionally, it is true. I mean, this is something that, again, in the history of newspapers, you have some spare column inches on a page that you have to fill with a small item. How are you going to plug that little hole on the page? And that historically is where you would find these, you know, funny little tidbits. The police report upon some bizarre criminal happening in your city.
Those are among the most popular, the dumb criminal, you know, the guy who takes a picture of himself robbing a bank and posts it on Facebook or something like that.
And even Beckford, I was looking through some of the things that he had collected. So this is the 1780s, and there's some stories that fit right into that genre.
Well, you mentioned the internet. Things have really boomed since the early 2000s. Is that something you attribute to the internet?
Yeah. So this was very common in newspapers for a long time. You'd have these little tidbits at the bottoms of columns. And then in the 20th century, you start to get these magazines that will start having, you know, weird news pages. And then that continues all the way up until the 1990s. And suddenly, on the internet, there's this explosion where you don't really need the weird news collectors, guys like Chuck Shepard anymore, who are, you know, historically had been gathering newspaper clippings from small town papers all across the U.S. You know, he had this network of informants who would literally cut them out with scissors and mail them to him in Washington, D.C. or Florida. Now anyone just sitting at their desk can find any weird news story published anywhere in the world. So you have this massive overproduction where anyone really has access to this easily, and you don't need those dedicated weird news collectors. So I think what's happened since the late 90s is just a huge explosion of weird content.
And what used to be an afterthought, I imagine now they have people on the weird news beat trying to find this stuff because it generates clicks.
Right. Well, that's the other part of it. So it's easy for anyone to get. And the second thing is there's so much material in general online that the weirder the headline, the more likely it is to sort of pop out of the noise of generic news. So it becomes kind of clickbait. So yes, it becomes its own news vertical, as they say. And dedicated, you know, magazines will hire, or online magazines will hire dedicated staff to just dig up weird stuff.
We're talking about how weird news has gone mainstream in the digital age. And joining me is Daniel Engbar, who wrote about the history and future of oddball journalism for Pacific Standard Magazine. With so many organizations pushing for that weird stuff, though, now, is it more difficult to find a uniquely weird story now?
Yes. I mean, it gets into a weird area. And I say weird area self-consciously, because weirdness is always going to be defined by being unusual. If there's so much weirdness all around you, is it still weird? There are these sort of thorny philosophical questions that come up. Huffington Post has a massive weird news section, and there are weird news wires that come from Reuters and AP now. And as you have this you know, growing supply of weird stuff, things that might have seemed weird 20 years ago suddenly are commonplace. So the definitions shift over time, and what counts as weird has to constantly be updated in light of, you know, the growth of the internet and the growth of this whole field of weird news journalism.
Well, maybe it reveals too much about the websites that I look on, but it feels to me like the Huffington Post weird news section, the articles aren't really that weird. Why so vanilla?
One of the things that happens, I think, is as weird news goes more and more mainstream, you know, maybe the editors have to sand the edges off a little bit because, again, you're going for maximum shareability, maximum clicks. You're going for something that is, you know, just weird enough to catch everyone's eyes, but not so weird that it's, you know, disturbing or icky, or, you know, people don't want to think about it, or they don't want to post it to their Facebook feeds. So you get this kind of, I don't know, middle ground weirdness.
That your Aunt Lois would approve of.
Yeah, exactly. Something that is, that, you know, it can't be too saucy. It can't be too dark. Of course, a lot of these weird news stories historically have involved unfortunate deaths or violence. So some of that's been toned down a little bit. Also, you don't want to offend anyone. I mean, sometimes these people, these dumb criminals, you know, you mentioned before, are people who are mentally ill. Well, you know, there's some very reasonable sensitivity we want to bring to bear on these stories. You don't want to just sort of mock someone for mental illness. So as this, I guess, sector of journalism has grown, it sort of matured into new standards and new sensitivities. I think that's a good thing in general, but maybe in terms of, you know, that glorious weird world of old, it seems a little less... it seems a little less edgy.
Daniel Engber, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Daniel Engber, he's a contributor to Pacific Standard Magazine. That's where we found his recent article, Who, What, Where, When, Weird: How Oddball Items Came to Dominate the News Business and Became Normal in the Process. Well, here's an odd headline for you. War historian writes memoir about his lovable pet owl. A charming story straight out of the strange news section when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From The Owl and the Pussycat to Harry Potter's Hedwig, the owl is solidly perched in the hearts and imaginations of children and adults alike. Who wouldn't want one as a pet? They are adorable. They are also fierce, with the sharp talons and instincts of carnivorous birds of prey. When Martin Windrow first laid his eyes on a tawny owl about the size of a loaf of bread, it was love at first sight. He named her Mumble and began a 15-year relationship. After writing and editing numerous books on military history, Martin's latest book is about life with Mumble in a London apartment and later a village in the south of England. It is called The Owl Who Liked Sitting on Caesar. And we spoke to Martin when the book was first published. It is now out in paperback. Now, maybe we should start with a little primer on tawny owls. How big are they? What do they eat?
Well, a loaf of bread is pushing it a bit, unless it's quite a small loaf of bread. I guess when they're sitting in their usual fat, comfortable-looking squat, they are about 9 inches high. If you could see them stretched out without that thick layer of feathers, they would be about, nearly twice as much as that. As to what they eat... Well, in a state of nature, they would eat any kind of small rodent, mice, rats, voles, right up to small rabbits sometimes. But they often, when they can't get hold of a warm meal like that, they'll eat worms, beetles, insects. They're pretty eclectic as far as their diet goes. They'll take whatever's around.
And they like the fur and the feathers on top of it.
Sure, they need that to make their insides work wrong.
Now, Mumble was your second round of owl companionship. What happened the first time around?
The first time was a dreadful mistake. I got a little owl. That's a breed, not a description. But the problem was it had already been born, if you will, and had lived for its first 6 months in a big aviary with other birds. So it was untamable. The trick, of course, with all wild animals is that if you want to tame them, you have to get them as young as possible. And the difference with Mumble was that, having learned my lesson, I ordered an egg before it was even laid. The little owl, that was pretty much a nightmare. Mm-hmm. It was very frustrating. And eventually, she escaped. and my feelings were pretty mixed about that, I got to admit.
Well, you named the owl Wellington, a rather imperious-looking thing. And
it was indeed, yes. It had a fierce stare, which it turned on me with utter contempt whenever I tried to feed her by hand or anything like that.
You compared that relationship much more to prisoner and captor.
Yeah.
But then you went through the significant hurdles, by the way, of getting the owl egg that became Mumble. Tell us, please, about that moment that you say was love at first sight when you first saw Mumble.
My brother, who's a falconer and who lived in the country, he had organized it for me. I had ordered the egg. And for the first month or so out of the egg, Mumble had been hand-fed, you know, several times a day by the breeder's little boy. I was expecting, of course, to find, you know, a cardboard box with a frightened scuttling noise inside it. But instead, I just walked into the farm kitchen, and there it was, sitting on the back of a chair in the sunshine. It was then, I don't know, about 6 inches high. It was a ball of gray fluff with two huge black eyes, and I walked towards it, sort of half expecting it to be frightened and to back off or scuttle away, but it didn't. It just looked at me. And I bent over and said, hi, and it said, hi, back, and it jumped up on my shoulder. And something very strange happened inside me, and that was it.
I love your description, shaped rather like a plump toy penguin with a nose job.
Yeah.
Did you know, Martin, what you were getting into, having a wild animal in the house?
No, of course not. I was full of dumb enthusiasm. And although, you know, I had met pet owls before through my brother, I really didn't know what we were going to get into. And so every day was full of surprises. And mostly they were delightful. Apart, of course, from the fact that you can't house train an owl. So things got fairly messy.
And this was in a flat in London at
this
first.
This was in a high-rise apartment where it was a condition of the lease that we weren't allowed to keep pets. So this was a hideout, you know. And that was complicated, but it was so rewarding. I don't know if you've ever kept a kitten. Well, this was like having a kitten that was teaching itself to fly.
Well, I never had a kitten that I had to lay down newspapers throughout the entire house in order to protect.
Sure.
Now, but why an owl? I mean, that's a question. Why an owl?
Well, I can't answer that, Virginia. I mean, my only reply to people who were astonished by this was, why not? Listen, I'll come out with my hands up. She was just so damn cute. And it just kept on getting cuter and getting more and more interesting.
Well,
I'm not an ornithologist. I never have been, even an amateur. But living with Mumble prompted me to get, you know, to hit the books and find out more about tawny owls.
Well, there is so much in your book about the evolution of the owl and of human beings concurrently. But ultimately, to me, it's a story of a couple. You know, you're settled into your various different routines of being a couple. I wonder if that ever got in the way of other companionship. I mean, you ever bring dates over?
Second only to the, what should we say, the hygienic problems, there was the fact that for the first, 2, 3, 4 months, she was as friendly towards visitors as she was towards me. You know, she'd let them pick her up on their hands and stroke her and make cooing noises, and she was just fine with that. Once she'd mastered flying and was having a great time flying around the apartment, after that, I began to have to warn friends. On more than one occasion, I had to actually issue steel helmets, which I happen to have lying around, being a military historian, because she would tend to land on top of people's heads and her claws. Oh, there was no malice there. It was just a landing spot, but her claws are quite sharp.
Well, she did love to perch on your shoulder, and apparently it's hardwired for tawny owls to want to sit next to things.
Well, yeah.
Are there other observations, though, of Mumble's instincts in captivity? For example, did she ever try to get away like Wellington did?
No, she never did. On one memorable night, I foolishly left a window open a crack too wide, and then I went out to the movies, and when I got back, she was gone. And the next few hours weren't much fun. But the story had a happy ending because she didn't try and fly away. She just sat on a ledge on the outside of the apartment block. And eventually, I was able, by waving her supper at the sky, to tempt her to come back down to me. And she hopped in her basket quite happily. We all think cats are full of affection, and we all suspect that they just come at chow time. Mumble obviously liked her grub, and that was our initial relationship. But she did seem to have a capacity for affection. She would come over to me and deliberately get up close and shove her head against my nose like a cat rubbing itself.
The she we're talking about is Mumble the Owl, the subject, along with Martin Windrow, my guest, of a new book called The Owl Who Liked Sitting on Caesar. It chronicles his 15-year relationship with the tawny owl. You kept a journal throughout your time with Mumble, but waited for years to put the experience down in writing. Why did you wait?
Well, the way she finally died, too early, she had years of happy life in her yet, was because some damn fool broke into the aviary in the middle of the night and tried to let her out, or tried to steal her, I don't know which, and she had an instant heart attack, and that was it. Mm. So, in the immediate aftermath of that, I was very angry, because this was senseless, and I was sad. And so I put the notebooks and the photographs on one side, and I got on with my life, I had a mortgage to pay, I had other books to write, I had a career to follow. And it just so happened that a couple of years ago I came to a gap in work, and I pulled out the notebooks and thought, well, let's have a look. And of course, after all that time, I'd forgotten what I wrote, so it all came rushing back, and I thought, yeah, we'll give this a go.
The book begins with a note from the Hawk and Owl Trust strongly discouraging people from taking in wild owls as pets. Anything that you'd like to add, Martin, to that caution? Or,
yeah,
a lot of people wish to have wild animals thinking that they can access some part of their wisdom or nature. What can you add?
My first and overwhelming thing is don't capture a wild animal, because what you're doing is taking it out of its natural environment, its established relationships, and imprisoning it. You have to be just about the first thing the animal sees, or certainly as soon as it's safe for it to leave its mother. That's what's necessary to form the bond. I had no idea what she saw me as. I mean, originally, obviously, I was mom, because I was doing the feeding. After that, I suppose I was her mate, because we were sharing a territory which she would defend. I really don't know what was going on in her head, but she seemed to like me, and she seemed to like living with me, so I didn't bother to analyze it any further than that.
Martin Windrow, he's a longtime military editor for Osprey Publishing and author of several books on military history. But his latest book takes a turn and recounts his 15-year relationship with a tawny owl named Mumble. It is called The Owl Who Liked Sitting on Caesar, and it is now out in paperback. Thank you so much for listening today. There's so much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, do tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.